Okay, I think we're all back. Let's dive into the final chapter of Matthew's Gospel, which has to be one of our favorites, because what does God do with the crucifixion? Now, seriously, if someone had killed Caesar's son, what do you think Caesar would have done? What God does is not to take it out on his enemies who've killed his son. God doesn't give death to his enemies. God's response is to give life to his son. This is my anointed, the one I chose to be your Lord, to be in charge of you. So I'm presenting him back to you again. The resurrection is the response of a life giver, the only ruler worthy of the name. Totally different response. Let's go into the chapter and experience it the way that Matthew tells us here. Now, the men are gone. They're hiding out. Because anyone who's a Jesus follower, if that's what happened to Jesus, and Jesus warned us about picking up our crosses too, we better keep a low profile. So if I imagine what's going on in Peter's mind, he's having a conversation with the others saying, psst, our best chance to get out of here is on Monday when the crowds start leaving Jerusalem. If we can hide in the crowd, make our way up to Galilee, we can kind of sneak out with anybody. Right, because his crowd's like, that's what I think is going on in Peter's mind. The women are facing this in a very different way from what the men are. The women saw the crucifixion. I'm asking you how this affected them emotionally. I think they can't sleep. I imagine they probably can't even hardly close their eyes because those images are coming back. And so sleepless in Jerusalem, they're just waiting for day to come so they can go to the only thing they've got left, a tomb. They've got nothing else. And when they get there, even the tomb has been disturbed. Can't they just leave Jesus in peace? His final resting place is no longer a final resting place. Can this get any worse? That's what I think they are feeling. Chapter 28, 1-7.
As the week faded and another one dawned, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And look, there was a great shaking, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven, approached, rolled away the stone, and was sitting on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothing white like snow. The guards were so shaken with fear that they became like the dead. Speaking to the women, the angel said, "Don't be afraid. I know you're looking for Jesus who was crucified. He's not here. He was raised, just as he said. Here, see the place where he was laid to rest. Go quickly and tell his followers. He was raised from the dead, and see, he's leading you to Galilee, where you will meet him. See, I gave you the message."
This is all utterly confusing. Are you emotionally bamboozled? You're not even making sense of what you're seeing at this stage. There's this radiant messenger standing there at the tomb where Jesus should be, and he's telling you that Jesus is not there. He understands who Jesus is. He knows Jesus has been crucified. He understands why you've come out there. He's aware of the crucifixion. He doesn't seem to be on the killer's side, and so he doesn't seem to be a threat, but he says he's got a message for you. How do you even start to take all this stuff in? Heaven's messenger then says to them, look, I want you to know he's not in this tomb anymore. Come and see. So they step inside the tomb, and there's the slab where Jesus had been laid. And he's not lying in state on that slab anymore. And the messenger tells you he is alive. He has been raised. He says you to take this message and to give it to Jesus' other followers without delay. And then he stops and checks if you've got the message straight. 2 points. They have to understand Jesus has been raised from the dead. Second point, Jesus is going ahead of them to Galilee. And with that, the messenger says, right, I've done my job, delivered the message, now it's yours. Now the message is in human hands. When there's not a human to carry the message, God will often use an angel. But God only does that for a limited time and for limited purposes, and then he entrusts the message to us. So the first messengers to whom the gospel is given, it is these women by the tomb. And they have been commissioned now to take the good news, the gospel, that Jesus is alive and is going ahead to Galilee, and then to take that message to the other disciples. The time is over when Jesus chose males only to carry his message to Israel, because that's all Israel would listen to. He's now given it to the women first, not because the women are more important, but because anyone who's a follower of Jesus is now a bearer of this message. It's no longer a male thing. It's like all of us together, and the women are available because the guys are hiding. So because they're available, they're the first gospel messengers who are entrusted with this message. So they take this message that God's anointed has been raised up out of death by an act of God, and he's going ahead of them to Galilee. Now, that if they start processing what it means to go ahead of them, they're going to start to think shepherd, right? That's what a shepherd does with his sheep. Jesus said, I will go ahead of you to Galilee. So he's going ahead like a shepherd leads the sheep. The angel says to them, don't you remember what he said? He told you he was going ahead of you to Galilee. And there's a quotation that I think the angel is referring to. In those last few moments before his arrest, Jesus told them, tonight you will all forsake me. Because this is what the prophets said. Strike the shepherd and the sheep will flee. But I am going ahead of you to Galilee. That's the text he's referring to. So going ahead literally is in a shepherd context. Jesus used this to strike the shepherd, but then the shepherd is going to lead them to Galilee. So the good news is that Jesus is alive and he is leading his people to where he wants them to go. I think it's fascinating that Jesus is leading them back to Galilee, because right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry in Matthew 4, if you can remember back that far, Matthew was asking the question, so why isn't Jesus the king in Jerusalem? Why is he in Galilee? And his answer is, well, Galilee went dark first. It was the first of the land that was lost to Assyria. It became under the shadow of death. And now the land that had been under the shadow of death has come under the authority of the raised up Messiah, the life giver, who is now leading people into life. Undoes everything that people had done to get rid of God's reign. The shepherd has been raised up and he's leading his people, restoring the reign of heaven to the earth. That's the message the angel gives them. So they rushed from the tomb to tell the disciples, and on the way, they met somebody. How amazing is that? See, Jesus isn't just sending them, he's going with them. Oh, that's amazing. He's not just the king of the planet, he's the king who is with his people. And he's got this message that says, go and tell my brothers to go into Galilee. He calls them family. The king has brought us back into the family of his father. So that makes us brothers of the king. Don't know how often you think of yourself as a brother of Jesus, but he calls us brothers and sisters. He calls us family. We belong in the family because we're in the Son. And so we share in his status, in who he is. We come to life in him and share in the life of the Father, just as Jesus did on Resurrection Day. We interrupt this good news to tell you a lie. While they were on the way, some of the guards went to the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. The chief priest met with the elders and devised a plan. They gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, say to the people that his disciples came during the night and stole him while we were asleep. Now, guarding the dead is not a terribly difficult job. But the point of the story here is that the enemies who crucified the Christ are still present. And they are spreading lies and deception rather than acknowledge that God has raised him up. They accuse Jesus of being the deceiver. They used that word in the previous chapter. But now they are spinning deception, bribing the guards, using temple money given to God in order to perpetrate lies about him. Because Jesus is the kind of king who has not killed his enemies are still present. And the point is that we who carry the good news will have to still be confronting those who don't trust him, don't follow his leadership, and will do anything they can to still get rid of him. I saw a placard in a protest rally recently, and this card said, "If Jesus comes back, kill him again."
What? That's horrible.
He's not killable, but the enemies are still present trying to get rid of Jesus. That's what the culture is trying to do today, just as it was back then. And that's, I think, why this story is in this chapter, why the good news is interrupted with the reality that we're still living in a world that's still trying to get rid of God's anointed.
You know, when Paul is in prison and the chains fall away and they, you know, and the guards are scared because
Philippi,
they're going to kill themselves because they're going to be killed. Wouldn't that be the same thing here?
The leaders, the chief priests and the elders actually tell the guards, if you get into trouble for this, we'll back you. We'll spin the lie to Pilate and keep it going. So there's collaborative evidence so you don't get into trouble. And probably some more bribes.
I could never understand this passage though, because given everything Jesus said and he did, and then now the guards are saying
he's
raised.
The angel and
yeah,
we're like
exactly.
Dead.
Like the hardness of heart, I don't understand.
Yeah. A person who is absolutely determined, I am not going to submit to God's authority, I am my own boss, will react like this. That's what we're facing, the hardness of the human heart, the resistance against God's authority, the I am king, and no one will tell me, no one will make me submit. Yeah, it's horrific, isn't it? Jesus does not tell his followers, so you've got to get out there and explain how bad these people are, and just explain how evil they are, and describe how bad the temple is and tell everybody to get offside with these guys. There's no fight. Jesus does not commission us to fight those who try to put Jesus down, who resist his kingship. Jesus tells us to go and embody the message that he is alive, to go and announce the good news that God's anointed is now in charge of the world, bringing peace to a planet that's fractured with so much violence. The violence was exhibited against him. Exhibit A for the sin of the world. But we're not fighting that violence. We are announcing the good news so that people can give Jesus their allegiance. Embody and echo the good news that God's anointed is in charge of the world. That's what we're called to do. Not to fight evil, but to proclaim Jesus. We've got one message. So what does it look like to announce that message? Well, in verse 16, the 11 disciples, because Judas is no longer with them, went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. And when they saw him, NIV says they worshipped. Literally the word is they knelt. So they're kneeling before the king. Because when we worship, it's an active submission to the authority of the one that God has put in charge of the world, God's anointing. That's what worship is. Worship isn't singing. Worship is submission to God's anointed. But some doubted. I love Matthew's honesty with that. There's some of the 12 going, but we saw him dead. This doesn't make sense. It takes time to process this stuff. And even some of the 11 are still processing what they have seen and what's happening today and trying to come to terms with all of that as they make their way to Galilee. But then Jesus comes and they get to see Jesus for themselves and discover that he is in fact present with his people. Now Jesus comes and says, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and convert the heathen to Christianity. Sorry, that's not what he says. But that's often how we've read that text. There's only once that I can remember where Jesus actually spoke about anyone converting the heathen. He talked about Pharisees who would travel any distance to try to convert the heathen, proselytize Gentiles. And Jesus wasn't very keen on the idea. So this is not asking us to go over land and sea to convert the heathen to our religion. We need to read this carefully and understand the claim that Jesus was making and the commission that he was giving us. So it's verses 18 to 20.
As he came near, Jesus declared to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been entrusted to me. So as you spread out, train all the nations by immersing them into the authority of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, instructing them to obey everything I have commanded you. And look, I myself am with you the whole time until the era is fully realized."
Now that might be slightly different wording from how you're used to hearing the Great Commission. Let's see if we can make sense of that. First up, all authority has been entrusted to me. Jesus is finally, plainly telling the disciples, God has made me king. So the authority that I have in the heavenly place has come to earth. Isn't this what God said up in the beginning? The very first verse of the whole Bible said, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and it goes on to describe the relationship between those two things. The earth is under heaven and the stars in the sky represent the reign of God. The word govern is there in Genesis 1:14. And God's kingship over the earth was the relationship between heaven and earth is what God intended in the beginning. And when Jesus comes back from the dead, he says, I've got it, re-established it. Earth is under heaven's kingship once again in me because I've been raised up from the dead and given this kingship, given this authority. So, as you go to the nations that are all going all sorts of different directions now, you are to bring them under the reign that Father has given to me, under my kingship. This is huge. This is not only Jesus as the Messiah promised to Israel. This is Jesus as the anointed ruler for all the nations of the earth. So he literally says, go and disciple all nations, train the nations in what I've commanded. Because Jesus is commander in chief of all the nations of the earth. This transforms the entire planet. And baptism is immersing nations into the name of, or the authority of, the Father who reigns in the heavens, and the Son to whom kingship has been given on the earth, in the power of the Holy Spirit who cleanses the earth, because God has stepped out of the holy space of the temple and he's now living amongst his people in the person of the Son and in the person of the Spirit, and the Spirit is cleansing the earth to be a kingdom of God, a place that lives under heaven's reign in the Messiah, in the Christ, who is now Lord of all. And that's why our calling is to embody the life of Jesus before the nations and to announce or to echo the message that God has given that his anointed is in charge, and therefore that every nation should live as the commander-in-chief commanded, obeying everything I commanded you. And as you do this, as we embody the community that lives under Jesus' kingship, and as we announce the good news that earth is back under heaven's reign, the king says, I will be present in that community. I will be corporately present among you so that you are in fact my body, my corporate presence in the world. And that's what the world needs to see. The world needs to see Jesus present in his people, in the community that lives under his kingship. In the book of Revelation, first chapter, John has a vision of Jesus. And when he hears the voice of Jesus, he turns around to see Jesus. And what he sees is a lampstand with seven lamps. And where do you see Jesus? In the churches. In the people that live under divine kingship. Jesus is embodied. I am with you. Present, embodied in the community that lives under Jesus' kingship. So the world can only see Jesus in his people. It will not do to say, don't look at me, just look at Jesus. Because where else do you think they're going to find Jesus? If it's not in the people who embody his presence, who are the corporate presence of Jesus, the body of the Christ, embodying his reign and echoing the good news that we are now under heaven's kingship, the way that we were designed to be in the beginning. And Jesus says, I am going to be with you always. My presence is among you always until not so much the end of the age as if, and then it quits. It's like until the era is fully realized, until everything that God has purposed is brought to reality on the earth. And earth is fully a kingdom of heaven, and everyone is under Jesus' kingship. Every knee bows, every tongue confesses Jesus as Lord. His kingship is fully here. It's not fully here yet, but that's our goal. That's how it will end, because Jesus is present in his people right now. What a commission. We're embodying the resurrected Christ, living as a community the way he commands, so the world can experience the presence of its king, its God-anointed king. So it's not about going and converting the heathen so much as embodying kingdom where the king lives. Does that make sense?
Is that the reason why a lot of missionary endeavours over the many years have gone out on their own, thought of this is what we can do, whatever it might be, and they've failed? Whereas the person who's actually kind of has the Spirit come on and say, look, you go there. And then just the whole places through his ministry or through his representation are changed. Is that in the same sense that you're talking about?
Keith, we always struggle to obey God well. So many of the missionaries that have gone out in the last, say, 200-300 years have gone out with a heart to serve God. And I am just blown away that God can work with us even when I don't fully understand what I'm called to do. So God's done some absolutely amazing things through those missionaries, and it's been fantastic. At the same time, we can look back and see some mistakes that they made. One of the mistakes that the British missionaries have done was they went into all the different parts of the empire and converted everybody to be little Brits. Colonialization became, let's all become like the English. So we weren't acting as servants of Jesus, bringing the nations under his kingship. We were also acting as servants of an empire, our worldly empire, and that part of it was damaging in many ways. So there's been some great hearts, some great attempts, but there's also been some places where we got it wrong. We can learn from where we got it wrong so that we're not converting people to be nice little Aussies. We're actually calling everybody, even Aussies, to be servants of the real king. So I don't know if that answers the question. But it's good and bad. It's amazing what God does when we offer ourselves to him, as many of those missionaries did. I don't know if that reframes the Great Commission for you. Hopefully it empowers you not to have to try to force everybody to get converted, but to actually go and live as servants of the king, embodying Christ's kingship. And then when people ask you, what are you doing that for? The way they often did with Jesus. Why are you eating with those people? You know, people ask you the questions, that then you get to tell, why are you doing that? Well, this is because this is the sort of community that God, you get to describe it. So echo God's message and embody it so people can see it.
That's actually a harder commission.
Yes, it is.
And converting people, converting the nations.
I agree. I have to agree with you. This is much harder than getting people to tick a box and pray the prayer and then we leave them, right? This is actually living in relationship with people, and it's much harder, and we do get it wrong. When we get it wrong, as we often do, we have a brilliant opportunity to apologise, to try to set it right, to do the thing that is caring for the person, if we're in relationship with them. If it's not someone we're in relationship with, we may never get that opportunity again. But ultimately, this is relational. This is about forming relationships, forming communities, living alongside of your neighbours, the people that you bump into on a regular basis, as people who represent God's kingship, and being honest enough to say, oh, gee, I really blew that one, didn't I? I was being selfish. I was stuck in my own thing at that moment. I'm so sorry. What was it that you needed? You know, so we have the opportunity to do that. That's why Jesus keeps emphasizing forgiveness, because it is about how we live as community, and those sustaining those relationships. And atonement is about sustaining those relationships. So we exemplify that in community. It's harder, but this is real. This is not just a theory or a belief system. This is lived restoration under divine kingship. So it's credible, even in Australia. It has to work or else Aussies are not interested. All right, thank you so much for the last 14 weeks, 28 hours that we spent in the Gospel of Matthew. That was utterly amazing. At the very beginning, we asked you, who was Jesus? Right in a sentence, his identity. I wonder what you would write now. We haven't got time to do this as an exercise now, but you might like to when you go home. How would you describe Jesus' identity now after listening to the Gospel of Matthew? We ask you to write down, what did Jesus come to do? How would you describe that now? What Jesus came to do and how the earth is different now as a result of what Jesus has done. Take a few moments, if you can, over the next few days, and fill in the blank on the last couple of pages of the notes. Write down your thoughts now. And you might like to take that into prayer as you think about what that means for our identity, which is derived from Jesus' identity, and what that means for our mission, which grows out of his mission, because that will define who we are, not just you as an individual, but who we are collectively as a community, and what God has called us to do together in his world. In February next year, we might see some of you for Old Testament prophets.